You're listening to the Prestige 70 Podcast, a collection of intimate conversations with contemporary jazz artists with an eye toward the genre-defining music made on Prestige Records.
With us today are two gentlemen uniquely qualified to discuss the career of Miles Davis. First, an accomplished drummer and producer, also happens to be the nephew of Miles Davis. He toured and recorded with his uncle on legendary recordings from 1984 through 1987, including the Grammy Award-winning album Aura, which he co-produced. He shares responsibility for the Miles Davis estate, along with Miles' daughter, Cheryl, and this gentleman, Miles Davis' son. A Los Angeles-based musician and producer runs his own production company while sharing responsibility for the day-to-day management of Miles Davis properties, not to mention a vintage guitar enthusiast. To examine the career of Miles Davis is to examine the history of jazz from the mid-40s to the early 90s. He was in the middle of seemingly every important innovation and stylistic development during that period, often leading the way in those changes, both with his own performances and recordings and by choosing sidemen and collaborators who helped him forge new directions. Whether it was the birth of the cool sessions in the late 40s through his time on Prestige Records with the iconic Miles Davis Quintet, or recording Kind of Blue, which remains the best-selling jazz album of all time. Into his explorations with bands large and small, Spanish music, and ultimately an electrified sound incorporating rock that attracted entirely new audiences to jazz, he never stopped pushing himself and the music forward. Aaron Davis, Vince Wilburn, welcome.
Thanks, man.
To the Prestige 70 Podcast.
Scott.
Hey, Scott. We're happy to have you. You guys have certainly had a busy few years here with the Don Cheadle film, the Stanley Nelson documentary. I think the profile of Miles Davis arguably hasn't been higher in a number of years. And I'm wondering, in the process of being involved in those projects and going around and talking about the projects themselves and Miles' career, what have you seen about his continued impact on music and culture?
What have you seen?
Well, I mean, Aaron and I have traveled the world, you know, of course, playing with Uncle Miles.
Yeah.
And one of the things that struck me is really amazing is we were in South Africa, you know, and we had the film screen premiere down in Cape Town. It's part of the Encounters Film Festival. And one night we went into the city. It wasn't a cinema. It was like a makeshift theater. Mm. And it was raining and it was cold and we were filming it on a guy's laptop. And it was packed. And a lot of South African musicians were there in tears. I mean, literally in tears after the documentary. And I'm like, wow. If Uncle Miles could see this, you know, after all these years and this documentary and the way he continues to touch musicians all over the world, and his, you know, at that time in South Africa, that moment in time was in South Africa. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And then we went over a musician's house.
Oh, yeah.
He had us over for dinner. And, I mean, you know, but we, you know, when we played with him, you get one, you know, one like wow factor in it. But then when we travel and we see it again, like, you know, to me, it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
And we talk about it. We're like, cuz, did you do you feel what we just experienced? You know, so it's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
To talk about Miles, particularly in the period the Prestige Records period, the middle 50s or so, you kind of have to talk about the birth of the cool sessions and that record first. And what's interesting about that, he was, I think, 22 at that point. He was really young and leading this big band. When you guys listen to Birth of the Cool in particular now, what do you hear?
Well, I hear him definitely departing from, bebop and fast chord changes and stuff like that. But, you know, I hear that, you know, exploring, different sonic textures, you know, just try something different, you know, and different arrangements, just completely different from what's going on at the time.
Yeah.
Not to say this too much, but that's kind of the beginning of him deciding that once in a while I'm going to break this all down and try something else. Mm. You know, or that's the best way I could say it, I guess.
Yeah. You mentioned South Africa. One of the interesting things, particularly about that group, was it was mixed race. Mm. You know?
You mean the non-Ed?
Yeah. And he got a lot of flack for that.
But you know what? I don't doubt it. But I also know him well enough to know that he didn't even care about that. Mm. Like if he thought, if him and you know, Gil or whoever thought that these guys were the guys, Kai and, you know, I can't remember all the guys who played on
Lee Konitz.
Lee Konitz, you know. If they thought these are the guys, then these are the guys. And then when they were doing it in the studio, if it sounds good, sounds good. Does it? He really didn't care musically what he would say things like, that guy, this guy. But I mean, the truth was, like, if you could play, you could play.
Yeah. Because the myth was that he didn't like white people.
Oh, no. Come on, man. When we recorded Man with the Horn, Gil would come and sit in the corner. 30th Street.
Gil was one of his best friends.
Yeah, just chill.
Yeah.
You know, plus Uncle Miles didn't care what color you were.
Yeah.
You know, and as long as you could play.
Right.
You know, he always talked about that. You know, I just want you to play.
One of my favorite quotes among many from him. I just told him that if a guy could play as well as Lee Konitz, I would hire him every time. And I wouldn't give a damn if he was green with red breath.
Right. That's right.
You know?
I wish could have witnessed the relationship where Aaron and I were talking about with he and Gil. You know, they were like brothers.
Yeah. Why do you think that worked so well?
I mean, I think there weren't too many people who Miles trusted their ears over or in tandem with his own.
Yeah.
Like for him, he could just decide himself if he liked it or not. But I think with Gil, like, I think they heard things the same way and, you know, they just had such a symbiotic relationship that I think that he was the guy. I mean, I met Gil, I think it was in the early 80s when Miles was rehearsing the band that had like Marcus. I think it had Scofield and Stern in the band, and Al Foster, and I think.
By the way, how great as a guitar player? How great is that? You know, just
nuts.
Just sidebar, just for a moment.
It's nuts, man. Yeah. It's nuts. But and I remember there, I go in and I'm really young then, like 10 or 11, and they're rehearsing, and there's this guy on the floor in the middle of them, cross-legged with a beaded headband with like these little feathers, perhaps, coming off the headband. And he's got gray hair, and he's just sitting there cross-legged with his eyes closed. And I'm like, who's this guy?
Like a shaman.
Like, do they know he's here?
A shaman. Like,
and then, you know, my dad introduced me to him, and I was like, oh, he must be cool if he's allowed to sit in the middle of the room while they're playing, you know. And I just thought that was cool. They had a really tight relationship.
Yeah. They had a very, it strikes me, a very unique way of communicating.
Yeah,
you know, and it was very much around, you know, the music, and while I never met either of them, my sense is some of that could have been nonverbal.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, probably. I mean, he did a lot of nonverbal communication, like looks and winks.
And I think Uncle Miles relied a lot on what Gil thought of certain music, like the Aaron said, the groups that he put together. The Man with the Horn, we recorded it. The We Want Miles with those can you say badass? Beautiful musicians.
Of course you can.
You talk about Stern and Skull, you know. But just think, if Uncle Miles wouldn't have been close to Gil, and if he wouldn't have hired all these bad cats back in the day, then he probably opened up he needs a Nobel Peace Prize for integrating, seriously, musicians. You know?
Yeah.
So black cats probably thought, well, that's cool if Miles did it. Well, let's, you know, there's no color.
Yeah.
You know, and it's great, man.
You know,
it's great for music.
Yeah.
At the time.
Yes.
You know, one of the things as really befits someone who was, you know, sort of leading jazz forward is that group, the Birth of the Cool Nonet, sort of set the stage for West Coast jazz, mm-hmm. for Jerry Mulligan and Chet Baker. Did he ever talk about the, you know, the idea that the people he collaborated with would then go on and sort of carry the ball, if you will?
I don't remember that so much. You?
No.
I mean, I remember him just telling us, like, stories where we're all laying on the floor laughing about Philly Joe Jones and
He had a thing for drummers.
Yeah,
didn't
Max
he?
Roach.
Yeah.
Why do you think he had
Tony? He was talking about Tony Williams a lot.
Yeah. Why do you think he had this thing for drummers? What was it about drummers?
Well, he said when he was a teenager, he and his boys would go down to the riverboat to the gigs, and uh-huh. the drummer was setting his drums up wrong.
They didn't leave. They didn't like the way he looked. His drums just looked.
They'd cut out.
They'd leave.
Yeah. And he always wanted Aaron and I to check out, you know, guys that played before us, you know, which was cool because he said, yeah, check out Max and Philly Joe. And we met Billy Higgins. I met Billy Higgins at the airport. You know, Max was really close to us. Our Al, you know.
We'd be on the road, like, doing jazz festivals, and he would find out, you know, like, I'd be like, hey, I just met this guy downstairs. He says he knows you. His name's Elvin Jones. Or, you know. Sure. You know, he was like, oh, check him out. You know, or I would, you know, go with some of the guys in the band, you know.
To move into, you know, the era there in the middle 50s when he was recording for Prestige, and though it was brief, it ended up with this what Bob Weinstock put together, these remarkable records that were basically done in, you know, very few sessions, quite frankly. But Bob Weinstock brought him back from St. Louis to New York. And the idea, and I'm sure Miles had a lot to do with this, was to find the best musicians, mm-hmm. and put him with the best musicians. When you guys listen to some of that music, whether, you know, Relax and Steam and Work and, you know, these incredible records, what strikes you about Miles in that period?
It's a good question. I mean, for me, I feel like he's like young in age, but he's very aware of what's happening. Like, he just has complete control over what
yeah.
Complete control in the sense that, you know, he's working and he's like, and it's happening the way he wants it to. Not over the music. I mean, he let those guys stretch and run, and you know, that's what makes his records really good, I think, is that the openness, you know. But to me, I'm just like, man, I love those records because I look at him and I go, God, he was young, but I mean, he was just like working and then putting these records out and, you know, getting the studio. Man, I love that aesthetic, you know? Like, it's just so hard to, like, it's all changed so much now, the way we make records and things. But I love that collection of records because of the way they were recorded and the time and where Rudy Van Gelder's and all that stuff. Yeah, it's nostalgic. But I just like seeing him as a top level professional. And like, he wasn't at Columbia yet, but he was so right there, you know, right there, just ready to
Well, go. And you can certainly hear kind of where he was going.
Yeah.
You know, as he moved to Columbia. But those records, those Prestige records, there's something so melodic about it. And I had a jazz pianist friend of mine, when I told him I was doing these podcasts about Prestige, and he goes, man, you listen to those Miles Davis records on Prestige, it's everything you need to know about bebop and swinging.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you could take those four or five records and that could be your education.
And they were calling tunes. You know,
yeah,
in the studio.
In the studio, you put together the best musicians, you know, and throw them the ball.
Yeah,
you know, and Uncle Miles loved. He didn't like after two or three takes. That was it. He'd call a session. But so you can imagine, you got all these bad cats, and they're taking it in one or two takes, and he's calling tunes.
Mm. You know? I would love to make a record like
you
that.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
Are you just calling tunes and you know? Like, if you're just doing, you know, standards or like, if you were blues, like, if you're just doing, like, old blues standards and Muddy's tunes or Willie's or whatever, that would be the coolest way to make a record for me. Just in the studio. Like, no, we don't need to go over it. Like, you know it. I know it. Let's just play it.
Play it. Yeah. Because when you labor over it, you can start to...
Then it starts to have this form, and it's like, it's not really cool anymore. Yeah.
I talked to Chick Corea yesterday. Mm. And one of the things, you know, when I asked him about... it's a good job. I asked him about joining Miles' band. I said, what was the conversation like with Miles as you were stepping in? You know,
did he tell you where it was in Boston or somewhere, his first gig somewhere?
Yes. Yes.
And he said Uncle Miles didn't say anything to him. He said,
no.
Nice touch, right? In between sets or something.
He said the only thing when he talked when he first talked to Miles on the phone, the only thing Miles said is, play what you hear.
Mm.
That's it. He didn't say anything else.
Yeah. I think he was just more interested in getting that out of, like, if he heard something, I don't know what it was in these guys playing, like, exactly that he heard. Like, I can't really speak to it, but he'd always hear something, and then he would just kind of get them in the band and just say, play what you hear, you know?
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Yeah. And I mean, those were songs that Chick didn't really even, a lot of them, he didn't even know at that point.
Right. But you know, Kamal's probably heard something in Chick
before
he hired him.
Yeah.
You know? And Stanley said some nice things about Lee. He interviewed Lee for the documentary, but he said Lee had some great things to say about Uncle Miles and the respect to color and Uncle Miles hiring musicians of color.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's the singular memory? If you had to choose something about spending time with Miles Davis on stage...
Oh, what's the one thing? I mean, there were so many things I learned from that time being in the band. Mm. I was nervous all the time. I hated my solos, but it was really, at first it was kind of like a project where I was like, first I'm trying to like fit in between what the drummer's playing. So we're not playing the same thing because there's no point. And then I'm trying to make sure I don't get fired the whole time. That's the other thing.
Could he be tough?
Well, he could be tough on everybody, but like I was like, I don't want him to be tough on me. And I was like trying to figure out, instead of just playing what I heard, I just was like trying to play not to get fired, maybe, which is the worst possible thing you could do.
Yeah.
The worst possible. So I don't know. I got through it, and then I said, after two tours, I was like, I had another band I was in. And I said, I want to try this band for a while. I was not ready for that, but I was like, I just want to go before he fires me. Like, I don't want to get fired.
How did you end up playing with Miles? I know you had a band.
Yeah, I had a band, you know, that was rehearsed in Chicago and my mom, at my mom and dad's house. And Uncle Miles used to call and have my mom put the phone down. And this went on for about 4 weeks. But he would critique us after every phone call.
Listening to you on the phone?
Yeah, I mean, like, have the phone down for an hour, a couple hours. Then he'd go through each musician and tell us what to work on. And this went on for about 3 weeks. And then he said, you guys want to make a record? And that was Man with the Horn. Mm. You know, and he flew us to New York. And we had a big room service bill because we were just excited to be in New York. And that's where, you know, you with Gil and Teal Massaro and Stan Tonkle and 30th Street. And, you know, but then the drum gig came up. And you know, with Uncle Miles, it's you don't think about, well, do you want to play with me? And you didn't say, well, you know, let me get back to you. You know, it's like, none of that. One of the things I remember is he was fearless and he wanted us to be fearless, you know, even if we were uncomfortable, you know, because sometimes great music comes out of being uncomfortable and being out of your setting or being out of your comfort zone. And shit, every night, man, it was like, Stay, you're out of your comfort zone. You just you just fit in. Like Aaron said, you got to find a way to fit in and make it work.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that he dug about picking musicians or what he heard in Aaron and I, you know, or anybody, you know. It wasn't nepotism. You know, it was like something he dug in Aaron, something he dug in me, Mike Stern, Herbie, Tony, everybody, you know. And for us to play, you know, he would have us try things and he's like, "Well, really, Chief? Inside, never to him."
Yeah.
But it always worked. He always had the vision, you know, and that was like, wow.
Yeah.
So once we tried it and it got over in the audience or on tape or on records, it's like, this is why he's Miles Davis.
Mm. One of the things that Chick talked about in terms of improvising on stage is it requires of the musician a store of courage. And it sounds to me like that's something that you guys needed to develop as you were working
quickly.
With him.
Quickly. Yeah. Quickly. Yeah. Right? Quickly.
Yeah.
And see, not just Chick, so it's all of us. Yeah. You know, we call it Miles Davis University. That's what I refer to. But it's you grow up fast. Mm-hmm. You learn your instrument fast, you know. But now I think if I may answer for Aaron, you know, if I could speak on Aaron's behalf, it makes us great band leaders, you know, and it makes us listen to music different, you know, and it opens us up, you know. We don't have just black bands in our groups, you know, or we don't have just black friends, you know. We have friends who love music, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Scott, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you guys were talking about guitars before we started, and you know, I kind of like, whoa, you know, because I'm listening, but I'm like, damn, you know, trading guitars with all these guys, and it's heavy. Mm. Thanks to musicians like Uncle Miles and Quincy Jones, who bonded with musicians of color. You know, it's great,
there was an inclusive thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you had the unique experience of producing.
Well, let's just say I'm in the booth.
Because you know, I was going to ask, how did that work?
You know, producing. Directions of Music by Miles Davis, always.
Yeah.
It's just that he would bounce things off of us.
Yeah.
And we'd take the tapes to him at the end of the night. And, you know, that's a kind of a big title to have, you know. But it was just, you know, assistance.
You know, sidebar for one second. I read that he didn't particularly like the term jazz.
No,
because you know why? Because he knew that right away that would put you in a different part of the record store, and then it wouldn't be featured as highly. I mean, that's one way of saying it. Yeah. But I mean, you know, it's like any time, like in our day to day things, you know, you have a meeting with somebody and they don't know that much about them, but they hear jazz, so they think it has to be a certain. It has to be in this box. It can't be in any of these other boxes.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's tough because he didn't think of it as like, well, I'm a jazz musician. He thought I was a musician. I played a horn. I have a killer band. We play music, you know, for people. We're not jazz. We're not anything. We're just play social music in social setting.
Social music. Yeah. That's the term he used. You know, I talked to a pop artist not too long ago who said to me, a young woman actually said to me, genre was only devised as a means to sell music. You know, whether it, you know, jazz, classical, pop, you know, rock, whatever it might be, it's more important about, you know, the artist, you know, what the artist wants to create. I'm not thinking about, well, I'm writing a pop song or I'm writing a jazz tune or, you know, whatever.
You know, I can dig that. One of the cool things, again, about Uncle Miles is he was always open to what Aaron was listening to or what I was checking out or what was on MTV.
That's the thing, you know, that caught me. I read something about he was into MTV.
Yeah, I mean,
he
would just have it on.
And the sound
would be down.
Right.
Or, you know, if there were no, first of all, there had to be no fights on. If there were no boxing matches on.
Right.
Then we could put the MTV or something.
Yeah.
One night I was watching Headbangers Ball really late, and Slayer was on. I think it was the song Seasons in the Abyss. And he comes down, and I'm like watching it, and I'm like, oh! And I was like looking for the remote, and he was like looking, and he was like, "What?" Like they're out playing in the middle of the desert, right? And then he kind of walks in the kitchen, and he looks at it, and he goes, drummer's really laying it down, and he just walks away. Like he picked something that he heard out of that, and I was like, man, he's gonna be like, what are you listening to? And, but he wasn't like that at all. You know, he wasn't.
Yeah.
He wasn't judgmental about it. He heard was this guy's playing drums on the TV. Nice. And then he walked off. Yeah.
And you know, towards the end of his career, he was hip hop, you know, DJs, Prince.
Yeah.
He had an open mind, certainly.
Yeah, definitely. You know, yeah.
About music. So am I right that once the technology got to a point that he recorded every rehearsal and show?
He did that anyway.
He did
that in the 80s.
Oh, no. We have all the tapes. Oh, yeah. Board tapes. Yeah. We had
70s. Pete Cozy.
86 was Concord playing. He had rehearsals before, and he had me with one of those micro cassettes recording the rehearsals on something you would do for journalism usually or something, whatever, yeah. You know, but... You wanted everything, like
yeah, document it.
I recorded.
How much
my
of
practices.
That stuff have you guys gone back and listened to?
Well, we cataloged all this.
Yeah.
We had to digitize everything. For,
yeah. Sure.
And Jack DeJohnette's got some tapes. You know, Pete Cozy had tapes. Yeah. You know, so it was way before us.
But I mean, I practice now. When I practice guitar or drums, I record all my practices and listen to them sort of once to see what I need to work on.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Because of that.
I'm wondering when you were cataloging this stuff and sort of going through it, was there anything surprising? Did you hear something that maybe just because of, you know, his career was long and he did so many different things that surprised you?
Temple Blocks, Tony Williams playing Temple Blocks for me was like, what? You know,
Tony tried Temple Blocks.
It never made the record, but I remember when Teal Macero got mad at Aaron and I because we were like, you know, releasing like the
makings. He was mad at me.
Well, making mad at me.
He was mad at Aaron Berkowitz.
Oh yeah, but he wasn't happy with some of the things we released. But you know, I'm always curious on how the Beatles made records and how, you know, the Stones made records, and you know, it's a great learning tool to have, you know?
So, and also to track how a musician or a band evolves.
Yeah. Aaron and I get in this vault and we're just like, you know, like, what? You know, it's like amazing, right?
Yeah.
It's like
now, and now outtakes. Obviously you're responsible for, what gets put out.
Mm-hmm.
What's the philosophy there? What drives you guys?
For the most part, we really try to put out things that people haven't heard yet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there's a format thing, like whether it's going to be vinyl or when CDs came out, everything had to be put on CD. But, you know, I mean, we did a lot of like live stuff. You know, we've done, we just want people to hear things that they necessarily haven't heard. I mean, some of the stuff you may know, you may not, whatever. But that's usually for me, that's the catalyst. Like,
yeah.
Try to give people something they haven't heard. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, make a nice collection of things. Like the Prestige boxes was beautiful, man. Like, when the CDs came out, was that 10 years ago, I think?
Yeah.
I remember working that record and just getting into all those things and, you know. But, you know, like we like to, we're trying to work with other artists and maybe, you know, collaborate with some of his music. Or, you know, it's kind of risky, it's kind of dodgy, but.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because there are those records, I think it was like 98, 99 at Bill Laswell.
Yeah, Pantalassa.
Yeah, it's such an interesting approach.
Yeah.
You know, to kind of reimagine to a certain degree.
Yeah, dub with Bill. Yeah, I love those, the record he did.
Is that something that you guys are thinking about? Maybe bringing in other, a producer, an artist, or somebody to kind of work with the material?
Yeah, we've done it before. I mean, we had Robert Glass do a record with some of his collaborations. We had, like you said, Bill Laswell.
Mm.
And then I think his stuff got remixed. Like all the stuff that he did, there was remixed.
Got remixed again?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're
working with Q-Tip on some things.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
I want to talk a little bit about the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, I read that, first of all, tell me about Stanley Nelson. Why was he the guy to do it?
He was the guy who, I mean, we had several, or I mean, at least a couple of meetings with him before we actually did it. And and some of them were 10 years before the meetings where we decided to do it. Like, he came in and he was, you know, we saw some of his films and, you know, he seemed really cool, but I don't know, it just felt right in the room. Like, you know, when you talk to him, and he's kind of like a no-nonsense. He doesn't try to, there's no, like, glad-handing, there's no, like, let's talk about something else before we talk about this. It was like, just, let's just, he's like, I'm ready to do it.
Is it true that you didn't see the film until?
Like a night or two before it premiered at Sundance. And, you know, that was our agreement, you know, like, we're not filmmakers. We're, you know, we like making films about Miles, but I don't, I'm not a director. I don't edit. I don't, you know. So once you turn it over to them, it becomes their project. And then, you know, we were lucky enough to, you know, he was gracious enough to let us see it before everybody else did.
He sent us a link a couple of nights before.
What'd you think when you saw it?
I called him, and I was crying. And it was like 3 in the morning, and he hung up and said, I'm asleep. I'll call you tomorrow, you know. But I was, you like Aaron said, we didn't know what it was going to be. You know, we didn't know. We didn't know anything.
Yeah.
Thank God that we hooked up with him to make that documentary, man. Because
it's a beautiful film.
Yeah.
Just a beautiful film. So, last question. I read a quote of yours, Aaron, where you said, it's taken you 20 years to realize what we're doing and how it affects the future. And I'm wondering what you've learned in that time.
I learned a lot. I mean, I gotta say that without Vince, this would have been shambles. Like, this would have been a hard job for just me and Cheryl to do, or what? You know. I mean, his mom, you know, Dorothy was there after Miles died, and Vernon, our uncle, was there. So it was like good to have. You know, their guidance in those early years, because I was like, I had no idea. I was still playing in bands, and I was still like, I don't know what we're doing. Like, well, is the box set great? You know, later on, you know, we ran into some issues, and we, to get through them, we had to make a lot of changes in our team, I guess. And once those changes happened, it was hard to do at first, especially for me, because these people had been with us forever. Some of them had been with Miles, even. But then I started to see things. I'm like, oh, I see how this business works, how the catalog business works, how having a legacy, having an artist who isn't around to promote new releases or collaborations or licensing deals or anything, you know. And once I started to learn really how to work this, you know, like I said, though, it couldn't be without Vince, without, you know, Cheryl. We hired Daryl Porter from, you know, to be our general manager. And, you know, these things were important to do, you know, because, you know, if you don't own the masters of something, you have to work with the label, you know what I mean? And that's fine. We've had great relationships. We have a great relationship with Kraft. We have a good relationship with Sony, with Rhino, and with Universal. But, you know, it's not always been easy, you know, and those 20, it's been 20 years. It's been a long time. It's been longer, I think, but, you know, I wasn't sure what we were supposed to be doing in the beginning, and now it seems more apparent than ever.
Mm. Well, and it certainly, I mean, it certainly seems, you know, given where, you could say broadly, given where music is, you know, these days, and I think there is a willingness amongst, certainly, you know, we had Miles Mosley here, you know, Miles and Kamasi and Robert Glasper and all, you know, all these guys, that sense of experimentation seems to be back.
Mm-hmm. I hope so.
Is that how you guys look at it?
Yeah, I'm glad it is. You know, people want, somebody called me about, he said something about Uncle Miles, but he didn't refer to Uncle Miles, but he was like, those jazz, I forgot how he phrased it, but that's already been done or whatever. And I'm like, listen, if you're calling me to talk about Robert Glasper or to badmouth him, I'm not going to do that, because he's a friend. He's like my little brother. He's a great friend to us. You know, we've worked with Rob, and we'll continue to work with Rob. Kamasi played in a band that I had in Venice at Hal's Bar and Grill. You know, but he used to always say, "Man, I got."
By the way, I remember that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He used to say, "Man, I'm just working on a little record, so I'm going to sub it out this week." I'm like, "Oh, okay, Kamasi." I didn't know it was going to be that. You know, his debut. You know, yeah. And Ron Bruner Jr., Thundercat, Stephen Bruner, and Flying Lotus. All those guys are friends of ours. You know, and if we don't have guys like that to change the you know, to keep the music evolving, then we're in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, and another thing I want to add is, a lot of times with legacies and families, they tend to squabble a lot or they don't see eye to eye. And that kind of stagnates the music moving forward or whatever they're representing. It seems like with Aaron and I and Cheryl, I'm always thinking Cheryl's going to take it this way because she's not really into music like Aaron and I. But she's smart. She's a woman. She's a black woman. She's educated, you know. And she loves QVC. So she's, you know, and so she might be thinking, QVC, what miles, female scarves that she likes. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, yeah.
I got to share that. And then with Aaron, you know, he just said some beautiful things about me, but I'm thinking, that's his father. You know? Mm-hmm. He's my uncle, but that's his dad. So it's got to, you know, I got to bounce this off to see where he is in terms of, hey, man, that's my dad, you know. And I never lose sight of that, you know. But I mean, Uncle Miles laid the blueprint, you know. All we got to do is just kind of steer, hopefully steer it in the right direction, yeah, as we've been doing.
There's really a path forward for so much of this.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, part of that path is the catalog itself. It's like, you know, what draws different people to different time periods of Miles' career. You know what? You know, I think everybody should hear this prestige.
Yeah.
These years were like
beautiful stuff.
It's like, you know, this is gonna sound so bad, but it's like when Jordan won the first ring. You know, like when he was in that level.
Chicago Bulls?
Yeah. You heard of that?
I'm from Chicago.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just, I don't know. That's corny, but I mean, just he was playing so strong, and you know that band was you know, I mean, Train was not. He wasn't doing solo records. He wasn't there yet.
No.
You know,
people barely knew who he was.
Yeah.
You know, at that point. But you could really hear, particularly in those years, how he was ascending.
Yeah.
But guys, as musicians as we are, calling tunes.
Yeah, I know.
You know? Yeah. Calling tunes.
Just do it.
You don't even have time enough to think about being nervous.
Yeah.
You know? But they're calling tunes, and it's classic. I mean, it's like... You know what?
And but that's the freshness that you hear.
Yeah, you get a group of guys together, you call tunes, and get it. You get those.
You
got to
get those guys.
Yeah. You know, get the top cats that you want, that you hear, and you're young, and you're like, oh, you know, either this is going to work, or it's not going to work, and it always worked for them, even at a young age.
Yeah. Well. Aaron Davis, Vince Wilburn, this has been fantastic.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you both so much for taking the time.
Really appreciate it. Thanks, man.
Thanks, man.
You'll find additional episodes of the Prestige 70 podcast at craftrecordings.com/Prestige70 or wherever you download podcasts. This episode was brought to you by Craft Recordings, crafting the future from the past. Edited by Zach Stilwell and produced by Laura Saez. I'm Scott Goldman. Thanks for listening.